From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, science writer Mary Roach and her new book, Bonk, about surprising, crazy, and even disturbing research into sex. Plus, Bay Area rock and soul band Isabella come to Sacramento to celebrate the release of their new album. And our new Thursday feature, Sound Advice, where Capital Public Radio DJs tell you about new music to check out. This week, it's bluesman Mick Martin. First, like most local governments, the city of Folsom is hurting from the recession. It's cutting dozens of jobs to make up for a budget shortfall of nearly $9 million. The city's zoo is losing several positions, one of them held by a recent former guest on Insight, and we thought we'd check in with her before she leaves. She's Vicky Scout-Valentine, for now Education Coordinator at Folsom City Zoo Sanctuary. Vicky, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning.
You're actually retiring from your position, although for a while, I believe it looked like you might get a pink slip instead. Tell us how this unfolded from the day you learned your job would probably be gone.
Well, once I learned that the whole education department would be cut, I had two choices. I could take a layoff and possibly come back in a couple of years when the economy rebounds, which we all hope will do within about 2 years, or I could take an early retirement. And the early retirement, there was an incentive by the city to give us a couple of years towards our PERS, and so that was one of my options.
But that means that you don't have the option of coming back in a couple of years if things look better, I guess.
That's true. That's true, that I wouldn't come back. There is a possibility that I could come back contractually and be a contractual employee instead of a city employee. So that's another option that I have.
How do you feel about all this? Do you feel ready to retire?
Yes and no. I do feel ready to retire a little bit, although, I'm 53. I wasn't quite ready to retire. But this is, education's in my blood. So I'm sure in one way or another, I will continue to do this type of work.
How many jobs in total are being lost at the zoo?
At the zoo, we will lose 6 positions, 3 people in education. We're going to lose a clerical person and 2 zookeepers.
2 zookeepers as
yes.
Well. Well, what does that mean for the zoo? It's not a big zoo. I guess even one position lost is proportionately significant.
Yeah, and that's true. What it means is that we just have to reinvent ourselves. I do have to say that I have to give credit to the zookeepers. They are one of the most hardworking group of people I've ever been with. And they'll, people will pick up a little bit extra here and a little bit extra there, and we'll get through it. It's happened before. I mean, there have been tough times at the zoo before, and we all just sort of put ourselves together, figure out what the job that needs to be done, and we get it done.
My guest is Vicky Scout-Valentine. She's Education Coordinator at Folsom City Zoo Sanctuary, and she's losing her job. She retires on May 29th as part of a wider job reduction at the zoo and elsewhere in the city of Folsom. What's going to happen to the zoo? And what about the animals?
Well, the animals, that's the other thing. The animals will be fine. And again, I would credit that to the zookeepers that are there. There's a group of professionals that most of them have been there at least 10 years. The animals will still get the exceptional care that they always have gotten. It's just, we won't have education staff there. But again, we're very hopeful that in a short period of time, we'll be able to relook at that.
Well, what does that mean, not having education outreach staff? What won't happen now?
We won't be the programs that I have done won't happen. So, in other words, we won't be doing outreach into the schools. So those programs won't happen. We won't have summer camps. We will have one small camp this summer that'll be staffed by volunteers, but we won't have summer camp. Those are the biggest things. We won't be doing a lot of the special events. So that will be probably the largest impact, is not being able to take animals into the classroom.
The zoo relies on people coming to the zoo and paying money. Is there a risk that by getting rid of these education and outreach jobs that fewer people will come to the zoo?
I don't think so, because we will still do our tours. I've trained a wonderful group of docents. They're volunteer interpreters, and they will continue to do tours. So we get thousands and thousands of school children that come through the zoo. So those programs will continue. The tours will continue. It just won't be the sort of the smaller, more intimate classroom programs that we'll do. And that's one of the things I want to ask listeners, is to please continue to come to the zoo. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that people can do to help us, is to visit or to join our nonprofit.
The Folsom City Council approved its leaner budget at a January meeting, and there were many people from the public attending. And Assistant City Manager Everett Palmer was quoted in the Folsom Telegraph newspaper saying that saving a fire engine company would mean closing the library and zoo. The council decided to brown out the fire engine company, and so the zoo and library stay open. But still, what was it like for zoo staff to hear their operation being weighed in a balance alongside public safety services?
It was difficult. I mean, I have to admit, it was difficult to hear that because education has always been the foundation of what's happened at the zoo. But again, because of the support that we've had from the community, there were teachers there, there were volunteers from the zoo there, we felt confident that the zoo would be fine, and we will be fine.
Do you live in Folsom?
I don't, actually. I live outside of Folsom.
Yeah. What do you think about just these general losses? I mean, there are 55 positions being cut from the city, of which 39 were currently staffed. That's surely going to have an impact on operations across the board.
It will have a huge impact.
It includes police officers.
It does, yeah. It'll have a huge impact. But again, I think what we have seen is great support from our community. Folsom's a nice, small community, and people still know each other there. So we're optimistic that we will find ways to get through it. And we're not unique in that respect. This is happening all around us. So we're finding that when people call, they have been impacted. I don't know that I know anyone that hasn't been impacted by these cuts. And so they're sympathetic to what we're going through.
Well, bearing in mind that context that there are pay cuts and job cuts everywhere, including here at Capital Public Radio, in interest of disclosure. But how is morale at the city of Folsom, in particular the zoo?
You know, I think we're fortunate. Personally, if I'm having a bad day, actually, all I have to do is go out and walk into the zoo. Yeah. And that, I mean, it's such a wonderful place. And you hear that from so many people when they come in the zoo. It's just, it really, there's just something upbeat about being in the presence of an animal.
Well, we thought to check in with you as your job is being lost because you were on Insight last August and you had a friend with you at that time from the zoo, Rosa, the rose-haired tarantula, who had just shed her exoskeleton.
Yes.
Is Rosa still around?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually have one of my tarantulas. I've had her for 17 years. So yes. And actually, it felt kind of funny because I don't think I've ever done an interview where I didn't have an animal. But I think I'm doing okay.
Remind us what the Folsom Zoo is about. It's an unusual zoo in a couple of ways.
We're very unique in that we are a sanctuary. We're a sanctuary in our operation and our philosophy. Our philosophy pretty much is that wildlife doesn't belong in cages. It belongs out in the wild. But there are times when animals need permanent homes, and that's what we provide.
I went to the zoo website yesterday, and there were just these adorable pictures of Snow Day. Tell us what Snow Day is and what the pictures show.
You know, one of the things that's really great about working for the sanctuary really is the creativity of my coworkers. It was at a holiday party, and so one of the things we thought is let's bring in snow.
Because you don't get snow in Folsom.
No, we don't get snow in Folsom. And so we actually had someone bring down a complete truckload of snow, and we gave it to the animals, and they loved it. I mean, we get to do fun things like, can you imagine what it's like to give a couple of monkeys a bubble bath and watch them play with bubbles? So we get to do some pretty extraordinary things.
Yeah. You retire May 29th, right?
That's correct, yes.
What happens between now and then? Are you trying to squeeze in as much education as possible?
I am. There are teachers who know that I'm leaving, teachers that I've done programs with because I've been there 17 years, so I have a history with a lot of teachers. So I'm getting as many programs in as I can and trying to do some training and helping out the volunteers that are going to be there after I leave.
And then what happens for you after that? Do you know?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. I'm looking at getting my falconry license, doing some of the things that I haven't, you know, I've put off.
What would that involve, having a falconry license?
Getting my falconry license, actually the birds that I have worked with are birds that actually can't fly. So this will give me an opportunity to, you take a test through the state. I will start as an apprentice. I'll work under a master falconer and I'll begin to start flying birds of prey.
And meaning what? As a hobby, or would that be a job?
Actually, you can use it a couple of different ways. Most falconers that do it for it's a sport. It's actually a hunting sport, but some actually make a business out of it. So there are falconers that actually go out to airports and do bird abatement. So you know the problem that we had with the plane back in Washington, there are falconers that will go out to airports and actually chase birds off.
A particular issue at Sacramento.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Vicky Scout Valentine, thank you so much for joining us again, and best wishes to you and your colleagues at the zoo, and best wishes for your future.
Thank you so much.
Vicky Scout Valentine, Education Coordinator at Folsom Zoo Sanctuary. She's losing her job. She retires on May 29th as part of a wider job reduction at the zoo and elsewhere in the city of Folsom. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, science writer Mary Roach and her new book, Bonk. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find our archives at capradio.org/insight. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, the complicated task of creating a Pentagon budget. On the one hand, you've got to predict future military challenges. On the other hand, you've got Congress worrying about local jobs. Plus, the spread of same-sex marriage in the United States. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. After the success of her offbeat books about cadavers and the afterlife, respectively titled Stiff and Spook, Bay Area science writer Mary Roach now takes on sex. Her new book is called Bonk, and it uncovers surprising, crazy, and even disturbing research into the act of procreation. I spoke with Mary Roach and asked what gave her the idea to explore the strange scientific side of sex.
I was reading an old back issue of Film Quarterly. I don't know why. I don't normally read Film Quarterly, but there was a reference to the films that Masters and Johnson made using, it was a kind of penis camera, and they would use it to record what was going on inside the woman when she was, like, sexually responding. And I remember reading that and thinking, wow, sex research, that's got to be the next book, because it's such a weird combination of the very private and personal, and then again it's physiology and biology, and someone's got to bring it into a lab. So that was how it started.
There are many just amazing, sometimes shocking stories and research in your book, but tell us perhaps about Princess Marie Bonaparte, the great grandniece to Napoleon, and her part in the story of sexual science.
Sure. Yeah, Marie Bonaparte was a fascinating woman. She wasn't really a trained scientist, but she did publish a study in 1917, and it had to do with the distance between the clitoris and the vagina, and whether or not that distance determined whether or not a woman would have an orgasm during intercourse. Marie had a lot of difficulties in the bedroom, wasn't able to have orgasm, was very frustrated. She considered herself a very, very sensual, sexual woman, but she was very unsatisfied. Incidentally, her husband was actually gay, so possibly that was contributing to difficulties in the bedroom, but Marie was convinced it had to do with that clitoral vaginal distance. And so she set about actually measuring a number of women, interviewing them about their sexual satisfaction level and how easy it was to achieve orgasm. She found a correlation between the two, published this paper, which was quite extraordinary for the times that she was writing in. And then her work was then picked up by, there's a contemporary researcher who was sort of following up. He's the one that told me about her work. So she was an extraordinary woman. She later went on to be a Freudian psychotherapist, at which point she had to kind of renounce all of her work on the importance of the clitoris, because, of course, Freudian therapists, Freud's thinking was that the woman should embrace, vaginal intercourse and vaginal orgasm. It was, the most important thing. So Marie kind of did an about-face. But the most amazing thing about Marie is that she actually had her clitoris at one point surgically, the tip of it surgically moved closer to the opening of the vagina, and sadly did not help her situation.
Mary Roach is author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. She speaks in Grass Valley this evening at 7 at the Center for the Arts. You know, it's impossible to narrow down the things in your book, but one thing that stood out for me was the youngest instance of human masturbation.
Oh, yeah, that was Kinsey had a woman wrote to Kinsey. Even going back further,
yes,
you're talking
earlier.
About this. This paper I came across, the actual title of the paper was Observations of In Utero Fetal Masturbation. And it was a paper there's the two images. Here's the little, the little tiny hand poised above the little tiny penis. And then in the next image from the ultrasound, there is the hand grasping the penis. And I think the guy described it as in a manner resembling masturbatory movements. So, which makes sense when you think about it. There's not a whole lot else to do in the womb for all those months, I suppose. I suppose it's like one of the few sources of entertainment.
Yes. Mary Roach, author of Bonk. Now, you and your husband took part in some of this research. You went to London,
yeah,
where you worked with a scientist. Tell us what this research was and why you did it.
Sure, that was there's a researcher in, he was at a university in London, and he's a radiologist, and he works with this technique. It's four-dimensional ultrasound. It's very, very cool. It's a sort of a moving picture, 4D, 3D image of a body part or parts in motion. And he had made several images. He had a paper on penile erection, and in that paper he said, well, the next project for my next trip, he planned to be doing a scan of a couple. They're, only the genitals, not the entire body, of course, because ultrasound is, with a wand that you hold right to the body, and you get a very specific localized image. And I wrote to him and said I'd love to be there when you do this, because I'm working on this book, and it's unusual to actually have two people coming into a lab and having sex. That happened, Masters and Johnson did that, and there was more of that in the 60s and 70s, but I thought this would be an interesting opportunity to observe. And he said, well, we're having trouble finding volunteers, so if your organization can provide some volunteers, I'd be happy to oblige you. And so my organization, being me, had to call its husband and persuade him that he should come to London with me. Actually broached the whole thing by saying, you know how you haven't been to London in 25 years? We'll go, we'll see Big Ben, we'll go to a couple of plays, we'll have sex in front of a researcher, we'll go out to Stonehenge.
It was very clinical, the sex, and it's kind of funny that the scientist gave your husband a pornographic magazine.
Yeah, he did. Well, not only that, he gave him a Viagra, because he put yourself in that position. I mean, the guy is right—he's right there. He's less than 3 feet away, because of course he has to reach around and hold the wand to my belly. I mean, we're sort of spoon in that sort of spooning position. We have our backs to him, but he's right there. He's right there in the room, and so it's tremendously awkward situation. So yeah, he did. He gave, but it wasn't a. It wasn't actually a pornographic. It was like a, like a men's journal or something that has scantily clad women, but not. I mean, and he said, this is very arousing. Of course, Ed's reading some article about Pete Doherty or something. He's like, this is not really all that arousing.
Mary Roach is author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. Just in general, what did your husband make of your research when you told him you were going to write a book about sex? What was his reaction?
Well, initially, I said, the next topic is going to be laboratory sex research. And like a fool, he said, hey, sex research, hey, I'll volunteer to be a subject. Not really thinking it through altogether. So he was enthusiastic in that it sounded to him like a fascinating subject, sex. And it wasn't until the nitty-gritty of the project in London was laid bare that he began to rethink his enthusiasm.
Mary, you've tended to write about the peculiar or the sort of things in life that fascinate people to a great degree. Your other books are Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, and Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife. How did you get into writing about these things, and what do you hope to achieve with your books?
How did I get into writing them? I don't know. I've always had a combination of an overactive curiosity and a very short attention span. I think that is what creates these books, because I don't tend to delve very deeply into a comprehensive look at a very specific thing. I'm kind of wide-ranging and scattershot in my approach, because I'm constantly setting off to research one thing and then finding something else that leads me somewhere else, and I'm going off on tangents. That's why I have a lot of these. I have a lot of footnotes in the book, because they're things that are so wonderful and weird and bizarre and impossible to leave out that I think I've got to keep them in the book, and they don't really fit, so I put them in a footnote. I'm a little ADD, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why exactly I am that way. I don't know what it comes from. But that's always been my. Even when I was a magazine feature writer, I was the same way. I mean, my approach has always been pretty much the same. What do I hope to achieve? Nothing really lofty, other than what I love the most is when I hear that one of my books, more often Stiff than Bonk for obvious reasons, has been chosen as a high school reading text. Like, that people are using it as, sometimes as summer reading or freshman year reading or common book for at colleges. And I'm always very gratified by that because I think science is getting overlooked a lot. Kids are not as excited about science as they maybe used to be, and I'm always very happy if the way I write the books gets people fascinated by science and makes them realize that science is the world. The world is science, and there's so much interesting stuff out there. It doesn't need to be dry and dull and boring. It sometimes is presented in a very dry way. So I guess that's what I hope comes out of all of this.
Now, if someone had read your book, Stiff, Spook, and Bonk, would they be surprised if they met the real Mary Roach? Because I would think some people probably imagine you as this wild and crazy woman who loves to open doors that make people uncomfortable.
You know what's really funny? I get more often, for some reason, people say, I pictured you as an older British woman. And I don't know. I'm not writing with an accent. I don't know. I don't know where this comes from. But some people sometimes. You'd think, given that there's a photograph on the back of the hardback, I guess these are people reading the paperback that are saying this. But I get it's two things. I get sometimes the matronly British woman, and I don't know where that's kind of upsetting. Not the British part, but just the matronly part. They say, oh, you're a lot younger than I thought. Oh, I'm writing like an old person. I don't know. Or, yes, people think I'm some goth necrophiliac weirdo. I get that too. I think people tend to be surprised. And I'm also, in person, not particularly funny. I'm not a ha-ha funny person in person. I'm not particularly good at, quick rejoinders and witty comebacks. So people kind of expect that. But to me, the written word and the spoken word are quite different for me.
You're well known for writing about science in a sometimes humorous way, but you don't have a degree in science. Your bachelor's is in psychology. When you were studying psychology, what did you see yourself being in the future?
I never actually gave it any thought. I was one of those tremendously naive undergraduates who just thought, well, I'll graduate and I'll find something. Someone will hire me because I have a BA from Wesleyan and I'm an interesting person. So I chose psychology because I wanted to travel junior year, do one of those junior year abroad programs, and the psych department was really lax about, yeah, you can take credits. We'll accept those credits toward your major. So that's how I chose psychology. It was never a career plan. I never had a career plan. I still don't have a career plan. I kind of forget what your question was, but
What your life plan was, but
yeah, I didn't want to be a writer. I had never written anything in college other than papers, which I hated writing. I started when I graduated in 1981 in the midst of a recession, honestly as bad, and the unemployment rate was as bad as it is now, and I couldn't find a job. I had no skills. I had no job experience, and I started doing copy editing, and that led. I'm not very well suited to that because it's very detail oriented, and I'm the kind of person who, I would say, I think this might have been capitalized differently in the second chapter. Yeah, who cares? Nobody will notice. So I was constitutionally unfit for copy editing, and then writing seemed to be the only other possible skill that I had picked up in college, and I just, that's the road that I went down.
Mary Roach is author of the new book, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. I love in your webpage when you talk about your career. And in addition to your books, you also write humor pieces that have been published in many of the nation's top publications. And then, in quotes, as well as many others, too embarrassing to name. What kind of publications do you write for that you don't list on your press releases?
When I first started writing freelance, I supplemented my income by writing for places like the Monsanto Company magazine or annual report, that kind of thing. I actually have an award somewhere from the Cat Writers Association, another from the Food Technologists Association. The sad thing here is that in both of those cases, I didn't win. I was a runner-up. The International Food Technologists Journalism Award. Runner-up, that's me.
But you did. Here's one award that you did win, and I love the fact that you list it. The 1996 American Engineering Association Media Award in the General Interest Magazines category.
Yeah, a category for in which I asked. There was one entrant, so that's how I won. Yeah, really, I for the many years that I was doing magazine work, I was really just so happy as a freelancer to have a steady income that, I happily went along and did most of the assignments that came my way. And, mm-hmm. Some of them were definitely not resume patters.
And finally, Mary, getting back to Bonk, I hate to run the risk of offending some listeners, but I notice in your book tour, it includes a stop at the Salt Lake City Public Library, which just seems kind of funny to me.
It does, doesn't it? it's an event that is arranged by Sam Weller's bookstore. It's an independent bookstore that is apparently, I haven't been to Salt Lake City in many, many years. It's apparently a wonderful independent bookstore, which just goes to show you in any urban area there are a variety of viewpoints and lifestyles.
Indeed. Mary Roach, author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, before Salt Lake City. She speaks in Grass Valley this evening at 7 at the Center for the Arts. On the other side of Salt Lake City, she's at UC Davis on April 20th at the Bueller Alumni Center. Mary, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Northern California rock and soul band Isabella coming to Sacramento to celebrate the release of their new album, Drugs and Apple Pie. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. At this time tomorrow, you'll hear author Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, speaking recently at California Lectures in Sacramento. Monday, we'll speak with the author of a book about Jewish-Arab relations in Israel. He's an anthropologist who spent years living in a kibbutz and in a mixed Jewish-Arab neighborhood. Also, historian Charles Postel on the high point of populism in the United States, and the Modesto Doctor, who's a member of the so-called YouTube Symphony that plays next week at the Carnegie Hall. Northern California rock and soul band Isabella keep busy. Although only formed in fall 2006, they've played several hundred concerts and just released their third album. It's called Drugs and Apple Pie. Their album release party is in Sacramento this Saturday. Joining us on the phone is the band's lead guitarist, Sean Leahy. Sean, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Hey, I love the title of the album, Drugs and Apple Pie. What's the story behind it?
That's a lyric from one of our songs off the record called Bittersweets. And it's just sort of a comment on the state of affairs of our little experience of America in 2008 and thus far in 2009. And the album we wrapped up a lot of our energy and our hopes into this record for, as a young band growing up, we did this record with a really talented engineer that we were hoping to get a lot of inspiration from. He really guided us well. And the whole Drugs and Apple Pie thing is just sort of this is more of like a comment on the state that we as a band have been in, trying to figure out our way as a young band in the world these days.
The cover is funny. It's got a small U.S. flag stuck into an apple pie. Did the band design that?
Yeah, that was our design decision.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that Drugs and Apple Pie comes from the lyrics of one of the songs on the album, Bittersweets, which you actually wrote, and we're going to hear a clip from that right now.
Your face. Memory. conversation that must take place. All of those minds are there.
Sean, there are really three songwriters in the band, you and two others. How do you decide whose songs get played and what order and what songs are going to be chosen?
You know, that's a pretty delicate process that we really don't give much verbal energy to or conscious thought to. It actually just sort of, we kind of just really just, you know, nurture each other's process. There are three songwriters in the band, and you know, the other guys are also very creative individuals as well. So there's always lots of ideas flowing in the group. And for us, it's more about just wading through all of the ideas and finding the ones that resonate the deepest with all of the members of the band. You know, with six people in the band, it often takes a while to get to the point where it's clear whether or not everyone is going to be able to really back something up and really support an idea. So, you know, it's a pretty organic process. Yeah. As time goes on, I'm sure we'll be more mindful of and whatnot. But right now, it's pretty much, you know, it's dictated by the process of the music becoming, you know, the art unfolding, whatnot.
My guest is Sean Leahy, lead guitarist in the Northern California rock and soul band Isabella. The release party for the new album, Drugs and Apple Pie, is at Marilyn's on K in Sacramento on Saturday night. Now, on your website, it says the band comes from the Bay Area. You're basically spread all over the place. Where is the band based?
We rehearse out of the Nevada City, Grass Valley area. And on our off time, the band kind of just spreads out all over Northern California.
Yeah. And why is your CD release party in Sacramento?
Actually, we're born and raised in Sacramento, and so we have a really strong familial base and friend base in Sacramento. A lot of folks come out to see us, and you know, also that's where we grew up. That's sort of our environment. So it just makes sense for us to bring out what we're doing in our hometown, you know.
Let's listen to a clip from another song from the new Isabella album, Drugs and Apple Pie. This is called Ain't Going Back, War Song.
To Iraq to tell Uncle Sam I ripped up his contract. We're lying in their pockets, we line up in graves. I'd rather stay home at minimum wage.
Sean, a lot of people think of Isabella as a jam band. What does that mean to you, and do you think of Isabella as a jam band?
Yes and no. That term these days has a lot of connotations that I think don't apply to a band like Isabella. A lot of people think that jam band means, you know, a bunch of long-haired guys staring at their shoes, noodling, playing a lot of, you know, open-ended improvisation that doesn't really go anywhere. We do improvise. We like to think that our improvisation goes somewhere. But, you know, a lot of jam. The term jam band nowadays is just, in my mind, is just a blanket term for music that is dance oriented that includes improvisation.
Yeah.
To me, it's really just an extension of where jazz came from. You know, jazz sort of came from the clubs, from musicians stretching themselves to entertain people. And that's what jam bands do, is they stretch themselves artistically to co-create with their audience and to entertain. It's one step beyond entertainment. It's like the audiences at jam band shows are the entertainment. It's because they are affecting the music equally as the performers.
I'm looking at the set list of your recent concert in Park City, Utah, and I see Salisbury Hill and Kashmir. I'm assuming those are the Peter Gabriel and Led Zeppelin songs. That's
absolutely
a pretty eclectic song lineup.
Yeah, absolutely. We do covers from all angles. We love doing soul tunes by, like, you know, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder. We love doing the classic roots music by bands like The Band, Neil Young, Grateful Dead, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. We love doing, a little bit of reggae, we even do some hip hop.
Sure.
You know, anything that you can pull from, you know, growing up in California in the 80s and 90s, you didn't miss out on much. It's like, there's a constant barrage of, you know, art, music, information coming at us these days. So you kind of have to assimilate everything you can.
Okay.
to broaden that artistic, that expression, that sound, whatnot.
Sean Leahy, lead guitarist in the Northern California rock and soul band Isabella. The new album is called Drugs and Apple Pie. The release party is at Marilyn's on Key in Sacramento on Saturday night. In the next couple of months, they also play concerts in Crystal Bay, Nevada, Stockton, Nevada City, Placerville. And tonight, they're in Chico at Nick's Nightclub if you happen to be up in the northern part of the Insight area. Sean Leahy, thanks so much for joining us. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, our new Thursday feature, Sound Advice, where Capital Public Radio DJs tell you about new music to check out. This week is bluesman Mick Martin. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to capradio.org/insight for links, images, and information about our topics and guests. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson has settled his case with federal authorities over how U.S. money was used in his nonprofit Hood Corps organization. That story and more later today on All Things Considered. A couple of weeks ago, we started a new regular Thursday feature in Insight. It's called Sound Advice, and it features Capital Public Radio music hosts playing and talking about new recordings you might want to check out. This week I'm joined by blues musician and DJ Mick Martin. His blues party airs Saturday afternoons on this station. Mick, welcome back to Insight.
It's good to see you, Jeffrey. It really is.
What music do you have for us? What would you like to start with?
Well, I often get asked, where do you get this stuff? I mean, that's the beautiful thing about the show, is I'd love to delight people with things. Well, it's starting to narrow down, and there are two places now that I'm finding actually working together, which I thought was news. Right now, Stone Ground, which features two Sacramentans, Sammy Piazza, a drummer, and Tim Barnes, a guitar player, two people that are very well known in the community, they're featured on Wolfgang's Vault. You can listen to music for free, the old Fillmore concerts that Bill Graham put on. And it's an amazing thing. It's been going on for a while now, but it's starting to get more sophisticated. And I thought the fact that we had a Sacramento-based duo of musicians, at least, would be kind of interesting to listen to a little bit of something called Chicka Boom, which was a big, big hit here in Sacramento and probably nowhere else. But I think it's fun that it's on the radio right now.
Let's hear some of it. Wow, that's funky blues, Mick. When was that recorded?
That was recorded in 1976 at the Record Plant, and it's one of two featured performances by Stone Ground currently on Wolfgang's Vault. What
does that mean, Wolfgang's Vault?
That is Bill Graham's music collection. Now, this extends into T-shirts, into posters. Wolfgang's Vault is almost everything Bill Graham, and that was his real first name, was Wolfgang, and he had a club called Wolfgang's. And this has gone through where the employees sold it to Clear Channel, and Clear Channel sold it to a fellow named Bill Sagan, and Bill Sagan started sending this stuff out where people could listen to it. And eventually, this started in 2003. In 2006, the Grateful Dead, Santana, said, hey, wait a minute, you haven't got the right to do this. Well, he's got the rights from everybody, and everybody does get their royalties. So you've got what's streaming and also what's for purchase. And for right now, there are two Stone Ground Record Plant recordings that are available for $10 a piece, $9.98. And I think for those of us who lived through the Fillmore period, and let's face it, that was a time when we always wanted to hear something new by people we liked. We now have that opportunity to hear the music on our computers or to buy it as a download from Wolfgang's Vault.
I believe that Wolfgang's Vault also has old live recordings from the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium.
They have a remarkable library. They have the Avalon and all of Chet Helms' productions. This particular recording here at the Record Plant was a radio broadcast that Stone Ground did. And this is probably the lesser-known version of Stone Ground, the better-known being led by Sal Valentino. So this is the one that had Joe Baker, who had recently left Elvin Bishop's band, and was very popular here in Sacramento. So it's fun for us. And what I ended up doing is I started looking into this because I was getting a lot of calls from people saying, hey, this is great to hear this stuff again. Well, then a Muddy Waters album came out, and I thought, oh, I can't believe it. Three Fillmore nights together on one CD. They took out all the, you know, Muddy was famous for having a lot of backup musicians who would do an introduction. He'd do 20 minutes. So they put all three of his 20-minute performances on something called Fillmore Auditorium, November 4th through 6th, 1966. It's got George Harmonica Smith and Ordis Spann, two of the greatest blues men of all time, on harmonica and piano. And it's come out on Collector's Choice, which is yet another special place to get music. So somehow Wolfgang's Vault has dovetailed into Collector's Choice. So we've got a Muddy Waters album. You don't have to download it. If you're not a computer guy, which I rely on the kindness of strangers, to quote some Scarlet Woman, if it wasn't for that help that I get from people who know about computers, some of the things I play on the show, I wouldn't have. Now I can buy the CD from Collector's Choice.
Let's listen to one of those Muddy Waters songs. It's 40 Days and 40 Nights.
Since my baby left this town, sunshine and all day long, but the rain keeps coming down. Why she left, I just don't know.
40 Days and 40 Nights by Muddy Waters. It's Sound Advice, a regular Thursday feature and insight. My guest this week is Mick Martin. He's the host of Mick Martin's Blues Party Saturday afternoons on this station. Mick, you've also brought in a very well-known track by Chuck Berry.
Well, one of the things I discovered is I was, you know, we give our playlists so that people can look them up on capradio.org, and we connect them with amazon.com. And I noticed that a lot of the great songs that I automatically thought, I got to play this because it's been a while since I played this particular artist, or maybe as a result of Cadillac Records, which is the story of Chess, I wanted to play the original artist. So I go to look up Chuck Berry. Nothing in print. And then Collector's Choice hooks up with Hippo Select, which is yet another label that deals for collectors. And there's a beautiful set of his 50s and 60s recordings. I can't imagine a world without Maybelline.
Neither can I. What about Rollover Beethoven?
Any Chuck Berry without... Life without Chuck Berry is like a day without sunshine.
Jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Roll over Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today. You know my temperature rising, the jukebox blowing a fuse. My heart beating rhythm and my soul keep a singing the blues. Roll over Beethoven, tell Tchaikovsky the news.
Wow, it still sounds great, doesn't it?
Oh, it still moves you. It still gets you. I mean, Chuck Berry was able to tell a story in 2.5 minutes or less, a complete story. He was an amazing songwriter. He's a storyteller first and foremost. One of the things that's happened with Collector's Choice, which was primarily just a label for reissues. In other words, they finally put out the Dave Clark 5, which a lot of people have been waiting for almost 15 years since they tried it, and it didn't work as a double CD set. So now you can get this through Collector's Choice. They're doing new releases. So Paul Jones, who sang Doo Wah Diddy many years ago, with Manfred Mann, and then created the blues band over in England in the 80s and is the number one blues disc jockey. I consider him my other in England. He's a great guy and wonderful source of information. His new album is out on Collector's Choice called Starting All Over Again, and I think he's 64 and starting all over again. So will you still listen to Paul Jones? And he's teamed up with Eric Clapton on this particular track. It's called Choose or Cop Out.
Okay, then do what you gotta do. Be who you got to be. Well, yeah, but when you say got to, you know what you really mean. Nobody gonna make you be anything at all. I know some things you don't change much, like how old and how tall. But it's your decision, baby, what you do with what you receive.
Let's Choose or Cop Out by Paul Jones. You know, we have a minute and a half left, so let's just squeeze in seconds of an Eric Clapton track. What track is it?
Oh, this is the first track. Paul Jones put together this band. It was Paul Jones and the Powerhouse. This is I Want to Know.
Okay, we are out of time and insight. We'll post information about these tracks on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. This has been Sound Advice, a new regular feature on Insight. Mick Martin, host of Mick Martin's Blues Party, Saturday afternoons in the station. Thank you so much for bringing in this really cool music today.
Oh, I had a ball. Thanks.
Well, that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Nathan Wilkinson and Rebecca Markison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. We'll